This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Hello, wonderful denizens of the internet. Welcome, of course, to Rack Addict After Hours, episode 67. This is a music and technology podcast. We hope you enjoy your stay. Today on I Didn't Know Samsung Made Water Coolers. What a thrilling anecdote that was. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Luke.
Hello.
Excellent. And Pete, of course, the fine trio we have today. Who's had a good week? Mine's been boring. That's always what happens. Who's got something fun to say?
I recently ordered some new whiskey.
That's definitely fun. Let's go. Tell us about it. Who'd you get?
So this is something from AD Rattery. I'd never heard of them, but I think they're a whiskey distributor rather than a particular distiller or anything. But I bought a couple of bottles.
No bells. It's a whiskey pun.
Sorry, I've ruined your joke there. That was good.
It was unintentional. I do apologize for the awfulness of that unprepared pun.
No, not at all. I love a pun. They're very punny, punderful, as it were. So I've bought a couple of bottles of the Arran malt, which is whiskey I've had before. They make really nice stuff. If you can get a hold of a bottle of the Bodega, thoroughly recommend that. That's a cask strength sherry finish, which is just lovely. And I've grabbed a bottle of each of the port cask finish and the Marsala cask finish. So it's their normal single malt bottles at 50% after being aged in, you know, a port cask and an ex Marsala cask. And I'm looking forward to trying both of those because they sound very sweet and lovely. And I haven't had a Marsala before. I have had a port before and it was very sweet and fruity for a whiskey. So that's going to be exciting when they turn up.
Delicious. Correct me if I'm wrong, but from a past life in the craft beer and wine shop called Inn at Home in Guildford, which sadly no longer exists, was there a James Bond connection with Arran? Obviously, there's the famous shaken not stirred martini thing, but I remember there being something whiskey related, and I remember a discussion around Arran.
I don't know, but I'm not a huge Bond fan. I do know that the Vespa Martini that he is known for drinking basically doesn't exist anymore because the vermouth he uses in the recipe, basically they don't make it anymore. And I think because the barrels are gone or something like that, and it's been replaced if you want to make it with something called Cochi Americana, which is a pretty decent vermouth. It's very similar to what they used to use. But yeah, and Vespas are entirely toxic and very hard to stand up after drinking. But they're fun. Would recommend trying one if you can.
The googly lord has informed, as always, it's Macallan.
Ah.
My bad. I got my Scottish wrong.
Sounds like Arran.
It's got an A and an N and another A. I don't remember if those whiskies were exciting at all, so do let us know on your purchases. I don't think I tried any of the fancy ones in my time.
Well, they're doing them at a decent discount, hence the non-frugal purchase. So, yeah, I'm excited to try those when they turn up in a few days' time. Actually, I probably won't open them for a while, but who knows?
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. One of my friends, actually, the manager from that job, he had a bunch of mates that were all into their whiskies. They'd go looking for the weird and the wonderful, and they'd kind of do the rounds among the friend group and then come back to the original purchaser, hopefully, with a reasonable amount left in. But I thought that was quite fun, just, you know, sending your whiskies around your mates so everybody can have a good taste of lots of stuff.
Pre-COVID, we used to do a similar thing where two or three of my close friends from college would do a sort of whiskey party, as it were.
Oh, yeah.
So a designated driver would bring one or two of us over to our house and we would share our most coveted or strange bottles. And that was great, but maybe that'll happen again in the future. Hopefully so.
The rarest selection from the cabinet.
Yes. Well, we have one friend who has mountains of the stuff.
Oh yeah,
and he kind of got us all into it. So it's always good. It's always a good fun and very tasty as well.
Nice one. Yeah, the tastings were always a risky endeavor at that job, but being paid to taste a lot of alcohol was a brilliant laugh. Always good fun, especially when, oh no, we've run out, we have to open another crate. Ah, what a shame. Those were the beer ones, of course, not an entire crate of whiskey. That would be horrifying.
I was going to say, Ben, crikey.
Oh my. I do actually have a little bit of this week in my brain while I think about it. Thanks to Pete's wonderful generosity, I have at last heard my own EP on a tape, and it's delicious, if I may say so myself. What an experience. It's good fun. So I now have a good little backlog to listen to. It's going to be nice. So thank you, Pete. Too kind. What have you been up to? Anything fun this week?
I've been taking advantage of the short spell of good weather. And I say short. I think last week we had 24 degrees, which was the hottest March day in 53 years.
Did you guys get the snow today?
And it snowed today, about 3 or 4 days later. Yeah, I got a bit of that. It wasn't significant, but I could see it sort of fluttering in the air.
Yeah,
it was a real contrast between
welcome to our reality here in England land.
Still quite strange weather. Invariably it's always put down to global warming, isn't it? It creates these really unstable weather patterns, and you keep getting these beasts from the east blowing down. But anyway, while it was good, I attacked the garden, and I'm not a great gardener in the respect that it's something that needs to be done. I tend to restrict it to the spring and summer months, maybe a little bit of autumn, but generally as soon as it gets unpleasant out there, I retreat indoors and the garden's left to fend for itself. But we did significant bits and pieces last year, and this year I thought I'd attack it a bit more, and specifically I was attacking the pond. I've got this
sort
of figure of eight shaped pond that used to have a waterfall coming down, a sort of rockery into it. It was all very nice. And then over the years, the plants have taken over and it's completely sort of clogged up with all sorts of plant life and gunk and so forth. So I purchased myself one of these dirty water pumps.
Oh, yeah. So is it have a macerator in there and it just sucks it
all up? Can handle up to, I think, 1 or maybe 2 centimetre lumps of detritus. So I had the pleasure of draining it and then getting in there and getting in there and start hacking away. But I think it's going to take several weeks. Again, the pond has been left to its own devices for, I want to say, about 10 years now. I mean, previously it was all well kept and we had koi in there and it was all very aesthetic. And then unfortunately we were plagued by herons coming down and eating all the fish.
Always the way.
So I tried various remedies. I sort of ended up putting a net across the whole area of the pond. Unfortunately, that net has sagged in and become part of the detritus and has sort of knitted together all the sort of weeds and other greenery that's all matted together. So it's one great mass. I can't really hack at it too much because the actual liner of this fiberglass, so I'll end up just putting a spade through it. So I've got to use sort of secateurs and shears and things like that and just literally manhandle the stuff out, and it's not going to be pleasant, but it'll be worth it in the end. I've initiated the easy bit, so as I say, I utilized the pump and got 90% of the water out of there, and that was very effective. So it's another sort of device that I'll put into my arsenal of tools.
Would you reckon the plan is overall you're going to kind of get it up and running with that little waterfall again?
Yeah, I'd like to, and I've been told that the several techniques to keep the herons away. One is to have a plastic heron, which I'm not sure about. That could look quite
a little bit tacky, maybe.
Yeah, possibly it could look a bit.
Well, maybe I could try and catch you one of my bike rides, and you can stuff it.
No, the plastic heron might not be too bad. I'll go and have a look at them. I'm sure you can acquire, you know, one from somewhere. I haven't checked them out. I mean, the other one is to put a little sort of like a kind of tripwire, because if it's an obstacle, and because something that's going to deter the herons with those great long legs, they don't like trying to maneuver. They're not great ones for sort of tackling unlevel ground. They like a nice flat, because they are a very big bird. I actually witnessed one land and strut up to the pond from my kitchen window one time before I sort of shouted at it. But it's got to have at least a 2 meter wingspan.
They're pretty big.
I mean, they're big old birds. It's quite shocking to see. I mean, my garden's not particularly very big. Another bird that big was quite significant. It's quite a thing. And at least that time, the fish escaped a fate that was to behold them. But other times, I came back and all that was left, you knew something had happened. The fish seemed to have disappeared. And it was just remnants of brightly coloured koi fish scales on the grass.
No.
So they're sort of slight, small crumbs that had dropped off the heron's beak.
fish crumbs.
Fish crumbs, yeah.
Oh, no.
But yeah, so that's kind of what I've been doing this week.
Nice one. But another slow week in the news world for us, but we do have a few nuggets. And of course, you know, we can't get away from it. The B word happens once more. Berenger strike again. The Poly 8, not the Poly 6, the Berenger Poly 8, because they didn't want to bother with fighting another legal battle, I suppose. But yeah, it's as you might expect. Visually looks a bit similar to a DeepMind chassis, DeepMind 12, because it's the wider kind of thing. I don't know off the top of my head, just in terms of the depth of the thing, if it is exactly the same, but as I said, looks very similar. They've just added a couple of voices. Doesn't look the most thrilling thing. Surprise, surprise, there hasn't been a lot of innovation in this particular clone. Who would have thought? But that will be here in some time, and then it will be delayed, so it won't actually be here, and then we'll start talking about when we think it's going to turn up, and it won't, and then we'll see it at the shop, and then Pete will probably start to hate it, and I'll think it's kind of average, and then we'll forget it ever existed.
Makes sense it's going to be in the DeepMind 12 chassis, as the DeepMind is a sort of reverse-engineered Juno, and the Korg Poly 6 was Korg's answer to the Juno.
That does make sense indeed. Do you know any good, not good, but famous users of the Poly 6?
No.
Off the top of your noggin?
Not offhand. There may well be, but I can't think of any. I mean, the Juno was always the one, and it wasn't really the Juno 6. It was either the 60 or the 106 that everyone sort of raves about. But maybe it's because there were so many Junos about when there was the sort of analog revival at the end of the 80s, sort of beginning of the 90s, the sort of rave scene. When people were picking up these particular synths rather inexpensively, buying them from newspaper adverts or secondhand shops, or because there was obviously no internet at that stage.
Yeah.
Using them for the sort of burgeoning sort of electronic dance scene that was sweeping the nation or sweeping the world at that stage.
Mm. There's some, on the old wiki, there's some big names, but no big songs. So lots of people probably had them and just sort of, fine.
Yeah, I mean, I personally had a Juno.
He had the real deal.
Didn't really have it for that long, about 18 months, I think, before I moved on to something else.
And in the synth world, one more nugget from the lands of Moog in Asheville. Pete, do you want to take that one away?
Yeah, so I saw this come up. What are they describing it? Moog introducing a complete synthesis studio experience. So it's the Moog Sound Studio. What it actually is just a package, like a bundle, really, isn't it? With the Mother 32 and the D-Flam, or the D-Flam and the Subharmonicon, depending on which you want to choose. And there's a few other bits and pieces. And you were saying there's a small mixer in there.
Yep, just a little really basic looking one. Plug some headphones in, a couple of volume controls, nothing fancy. I think there's a solution for daisy chaining the power as well.
I couldn't really see it properly. It's nothing significant, is it? It's just a...
No, not at all.
Is there any controls? Because there's not a very good...
I think it's just a volume for the headphones, and that's your lot.
There's a little rack thing for your patch leads.
It's kind of neat. Not in the an especially useful location, but then it's there.
So I'm just wondering what the motivation. I get the feeling that potentially maybe the sales are slipping a bit on these, and it's another way of repackaging it.
That's all that I can think makes sense.
I would have thought, I mean, I don't necessarily see a lot of these being sold, because I would imagine most people who are going to get either one of these or several of these have already got them.
Totally. So what's the options? Mother 32 and DFAM, and then is it Subharmonicon and DFAM?
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose DFAM's never the first one that people would go for, unless they've already got quite a sizable synth collection.
There didn't seem to be much of a saving. Well, there's no saving to be had. I think this is more expensive. So, I mean, it's almost cheaper to buy them individually anyway.
Yeah, I think the mixer has a daisy chaining power supply type situation in it. So that's kind of useful if you don't want to suck up a bunch of wall sockets. But that's all I can think, really.
So. I mean, a lot of these are re-racked, aren't they? They're sort of mounted in people's Eurac systems anyway.
Mm, if they're lucky enough to have lots of space.
I never got round to it because it was black. It couldn't go into my system just for the fact it was the wrong colour. So mine stayed outside the moth.
And then didn't you sell it anyway?
And subsequently I sold it because I really didn't use it at all. And then it was just sitting there and I thought I need to try it out, see what I can do with it. And I was a bit, it's just, you know, very, it just didn't, I mean, it was exciting when it first came out and I ordered one and had a sort of 2 month wait.
Yeah.
And then, as I said the other week, when I got it, it just kind of went on the side, sat there.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about that it's only a single oscillator, it does sound really nice, but the sequence is kind of frustrating and it's not especially interesting in any other way.
I thought the sequencer was very obtruse in its functionality. That if I get anything and I start really struggling to use it, it's a bit of a buzzkill straight away. You want a certain amount of intuitiveness built in. You want to get some sort of instant results, even if there's a need to dig further later on. But you want to get something initially. You don't want to be sort of flummoxed and sort of bored with something, you know, within the first 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah, definitely. In the absence of really juicy, newsworthy nuggets, I thought it might be a little bit of a laugh if we played a game that we've played with the ModCaf a couple of times. It's very simple. First, I ask you, Luke.
Hello.
What is your favourite time of day in the autumn?
In the autumn? That sort of...
Just give me a time on the clock. That's all we need.
Oh, okay. 11.
What is to your 11 o'clock right now that is interesting and you can describe to us that we might find interesting? Interesting. Did I say interesting?
Okay. Humorously, it's more booze.
Excellent.
It says something about the state of my desk, doesn't it, really? So,
do you work there?
Yeah, kind of. Ooh. At the moment. So
a rich amber colour I see.
Yes. This is rum. This is Foursquare 2007 single blended rum. It is, there are loads of descriptors, but basically it's a 12-year-old ex-bourbon pot and column blend, fine Barbadian rum. And it's just, it's very nice. It's just very nice rum. And it's ridiculously strong at 59% ABV, which is very tasty. Yeah.
Nice one. Pete, a similar but slightly different question. What time is too late to still call it breakfast?
11:30, I would say.
What is to your 11:30 direction? That's how the game goes. What have you got that might intrigue our listeners?
11:30. I've got to adjust my clock, haven't I? Which bit? When you say 11:30, we're talking about the minute hand or the hour hand?
No, just go for your hour hand.
Go for my hour hand. So it's a Genulec 8051.
Aha. They're massive, aren't they? I remember seeing your room. They're a big presence in there.
They're the same as the ones we have in the shop on the floor next to the keyboard.
Ah.
It's the same physical size. They're not the same.
I think they look smaller when they're on the floor.
Yeah, yeah. And they're on their side in the shop.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're quite big and I've got them at head height on pedestals. Yeah. So
wow,
how long have they been your primary listening tool?
I want to say 5 years now. 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
I mean, time.
What did you have before?
HS80s. There's not a lot different between an HS80 and an HS8. I don't know why they dropped the zero, to be honest. Look like the, I mean, there might be some changes to those Yamaha speakers, but they look exactly the same as the ones I had, which were 80s. But yeah, that's apart from the microphone, which is in your face.
Yeah.
But yeah, with Genulex, or one of them.
When you'd sort of been to studios or potentially with your colleagues and mates, why did Genulec particularly intrigue you? Why'd you end up going Genulec?
Just seeing, and I did this before I'd had sort of worked in the store, so I hadn't listened to comprehensively to all the other sort of models in the range. It was just that every studio tour, virtually, I mean, it seems like it's not every studio tour, but the good proportion of all the studio tours that you saw, and especially ones of notable producers, there was always a pair of Genulecs lurking. And generally, I sort of got the vibe that they were the ones to have. I don't know. It just seemed to be the right move at the time.
Nice one.
I don't sit there thinking about, I need to get some more studio monitors. As far as I'm concerned, if these last the rest of my life, that'll be fine.
It sounds like a good thing that you don't necessarily notice them. They just do their thing.
Unless I had a particularly bigger studio and I'd want some sort of midfield or far field speakers as well, but the Genulecs would stay anyway. But as far as near field speakers go, there's no other particular brand or model or anything like that I have a hankering after.
It's a very anecdotal thing, but in our experience and in my experience, whenever we've been to a studio or had any involvement with the studio, seeing some Jennies on the desk is usually a very good sign that you're going to get a decent product out of the producing, or the producer, as it were. Yeah, they're high quality speakers from what I understand, and they're quite clear as well in terms of they don't colour the sound very, very much at all.
Yeah, they're often described as being very honest.
Yeah, which is really quite something that's quite useful to know in music when you're mixing, because I mean, just in my own experience, I've got some pre-Sonus Erises, I think, and they're fine, but they suck a lot of bass out of the song. So I'll listen to something and go, oh gosh, that's dark on a different medium, which is not ideal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just checking. I'm just, my head's so full of numbers, and we've now got those 83 series in, or yeah. I think they're just the 8350 ones, aren't they? In the...
Yeah, the point source, yeah. Concentric-y doodads.
But as I say, even those, I haven't had any sort of thinking, oh, I must get those now. I mean, as I say, mine are fine. I actually leave them switched off a lot of the time now, because I work in headphones a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Because I just don't want to disturb people. I'm finding myself working later and later.
Yeah.
And even when I can, because I'm so used to working in headphones, I don't necessarily switch them on as much as I should do. But they were on a lot of the time, and now I think, oh, I might as well leave them off because they're just cooking.
Yeah. Okay, one of you's got to give me an hour-based question.
Okay.
This isn't actually my space, but there's definitely lots of interesting stuff in here.
At what time of the day would you say is far too late to get up? Assuming you were not at work.
The day always goes pretty downhill much past one.
Yeah.
I would say. So over here, let me not knock my laptop off the thing. There is an empty flight case. Try again.
Okay. What time would you say is far too early to get up?
Ooh, it's got to be six.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've got a Yamaha HS, whatever it is, subwoofer down there, which was part of the 5.1 that we've got in this room, which is HS5s the rest of the way, which I quite like this space, because it's the first time I ever, let me rephrase that, first and only time I've actually used my degree for anything. So my final project was all about surround sound, creative uses of surround sound in performance. And we had a big corporate project that required a 5.1 mix, because pharmaceuticals companies have lots of money, I guess. So I did a 5.1 mix in here, and it's the only one I've had to do. But we had the space for it, so it's okay.
So the Yamaha system works quite well. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the HS series. You know, they come in, you know, they're very affordable and so forth. But they are a bit hi-fi-y, I thought.
Yeah, and there's that upper mid laser beam that just kind of destroys your brain after a little bit. But normally there's A7Xs in here as the main speakers. But they'll do for an affordable 5.1.
Yeah.
And there we are. You know what that means? We finished our newsworthy something. It can only mean that we must board a spacefaring vessel and launch ourselves towards Luke's Spacey Bit. I do enjoy pivoting around stupid segues. What have you got for us?
Well, in a bizarre happenstance, that segue actually works quite well, because the first time I witnessed the film for which the inspiration for this piece comes was after my dad had bought in 2000 and whenever it was a 5.1 surround sound system, because Dolby Digital had come to DVD and 5.1
it's
was
like
a thing
we
you
planned
could do.
It amazing.
Yeah. And so I have this really fond childhood memory of watching Star Wars Attack of the Clones on DVD on a HDTV. Like, it was my dad basically kitted the lounge out from, like, it was we'd upgraded from CRT to flat screen for the first time, and
it's a big move.
Of course, that also meant that the man at Curry's or Dixon's probably back then managed to upsell him a set of 5.1 surround sound Sony speakers, and I loved them. I think they were amazing. So we had a little sub.
He's still living on an island with that commission to
day. Oh yeah, Christ. Especially back then. So we had a little tiny 5.1 speaker system all around the living room on these bizarre thin metal stands that would fall over with a puff of wind. And but it made watching the movies with the volume up absolutely fantastic. It was to me, I think I would have been, I don't know, how old was I when Attack of the Clones came out? Probably 13 or 14. It was like going to the cinema. It was absolutely stupendous. And so recently, my partner and I have been re-watching the entire Star Wars series now that it's available on Disney Plus from top to bottom. And we recently watched Attack of the Clones, and there's a chase scene through an asteroid field. And the asteroid field is actually part of a series of rings around a planet called Geonosis, which is looks a bit like Saturn. We were watching this film, and Steph turns and says to me, does Saturn actually look like that close up? And I said, I think so, but I don't actually know the answer. So I went and did some digging. And hence, I learned that, as usual, with space, there's always way more to know than you bargained for. So, briefly...
All I wanted was to know the answer to a simple question.
Yeah, yes.
And now I'm applying for a degree in astrophysics.
Absolutely. So, in the film, there's miles and miles of asteroids up and down in a 3D sense. So the depth of this ring that they fly into in the film is very deep, deep enough to facilitate a sort of space car chase scene, and deep enough that they can go on for, you know, miles and miles without needing to worry about running out of cover. And some of these rocks are absolutely enormous. They fill up the whole screen. They're bigger than the ships that are flying through them. And so I thought, well, okay, how close to that is that to reality in terms of what Saturn looks like? And according to NASA, the rings of Saturn are thought to be pieces of comets, asteroids, or shattered proto or post moons, broken up and teased out into relatively thin dishes of matter orbiting around Saturn's equatorial plane. And because Saturn is inclined at a 27 degree inclination to us, we see the rings in a kind of rotating profile, so we actually get to see quite a nice full-on view of them every time Saturn turns around, which is really quite nice. And that's why Galileo and people like him could observe them with primitive telescopes even way back when. So that's why Saturn's been so fascinating, I think, to astronomers for so long. But the structure of the rings is something we've only really recently come to understand properly. They can be thought of as a sort of thin cloud filled with mostly fine dust and sometimes larger clumps of rock and ice. The ring system starts at around 7,000 kilometers from the outer surface of the atmosphere and ends at about 80,000 kilometers away, which is an enormous span of distance. And Saturn is no small planet. It's one of the gas giants of the solar system. So we're talking about some seriously large stretches of space and around an absolutely enormous planet as it is, just to give you some idea. The really weird part is that the depth of the rings is about, on average, 10 meters.
No way.
Yeah, so they're incredibly thin. Some parts of it are as thick as 1 kilometer because there are some larger chunks of stuff in some of the middle rings, but broadly speaking, you could sort of stand on it and kind of almost poke your head through the other side if you jumped. You know, they're not very big at all. In terms of how deep they are. So it's almost as if this moon, if you imagine, has been pressed and squished into a really thin paste going around the planet. I struggled to try and visualize it, and I wondered, okay, so if you get that close to Saturn, does it really look like that? And the answer is, as usual, kind of. So the vast majority of this is dust-sized matter, ranging from grains of sand up to chunks as big as a house. The average majority of particles sits between 1 and 10 centimeters in size. A few notable rocks are as big as a mountain, but they're not common, and they're referred to as moonlets with their own unique designation. One of them is called S2009S1, which is hidden in the B ring, which is the sort of one of the middle rings of the. And we'll come to that in a second because they're not laid out in order, in terms of alphabetical order anyway. It's estimated to be about 400 meters in diameter, this moonlet. So there's some quite sizable objects in there, but they're not commonplace. So again, this idea of being flying through a huge asteroid field full of loads and loads of enormous mountainous rocks from the film is kind of, in terms of what Saturn is like, the only thing we can compare it to, is not realistic. The huge parts of Saturn's rings appear to be very few and far between. As a result, the majority of it is kind of this either something akin to a cloud or lots and lots of sand or small chunks, which is interesting how smooth it looks from far away. So the Cassini spacecraft has massively improved our understanding of Saturn, being the first spacecraft to take what passes for orbital close-up images. During its operational lifetime, it inclined its orbit so that it was able to dive through the rings and take images of them in cross-section profile as it went, which was something we'd never done before. I would encourage our listeners and you guys as well to take some time to look at what the internal structure of the rings looks like from Cassini's point of view. It's some absolutely wonderful photos. And you can start to see the smoothness of the rings in those photos break down into something that kind of looks like a shower of sparks or a shower of sand, as it were. And still, it's difficult to comprehend, but even those images are taken from, you know, tens of kilometers away. So they, on closer inspection, again, that smoothness will break down and you will start to see what looks something like what you see in Star Wars. But again, they're not as massive. Those rocks, those particles are not as massive as the sort of common Hollywood depiction would have you believe. They're much smaller, almost like kind of large chunks of sand, football sized, ranging down to really small fine particulate matter. So again, really interesting how they look so fine from and so smooth and silky from a distance. But again, that's down to the enormous size of the rings and the distances from which we're observing them. It's absolutely fantastic. So the last part of this that I wanted to bring up was how lucky we are to actually be able to see those rings in the context of when they were formed and how long they're going to be around for. So recently a scientist published some data based on some of Cassini's findings to say that these rings are actually being sublimated in a way down into Saturn's atmosphere. So kind of what's happening is that parts of the ring are being charged by interactions with cosmic rays and just friction as well. And they're falling down into Saturn as the matter is being drawn down by the magnetosphere of the planet, kind of making all of the matter charged in a way that it wouldn't be normally, and then it's pulled down into the atmosphere and it burns up or is absorbed into the mass of Saturn itself. Fortunately, this process is going to take about 300 million years to rob Saturn entirely of its rings, but they are disappearing. And considering the age of the solar system and the sort of coincidence that we've come to exist in the same system as Saturn at the same time as those rings are actually there, it's a very small likelihood that those things would happen. So we're quite lucky to be able to actually witness those rings. And like I say, if you see some of these close-up images, they really are quite beautiful. So they will disappear, but fortunately not for a very long time.
We won't notice.
Well, we won't
notice.
You
said because of the angle that Saturn's kind of tilted at, that's kind of what means that we can see them. Are they something that when you can see Saturn, you can always see the rings, or is it kind of rotation sometimes line them up, sort of, you know?
Yes.
The thin edge and all that?
Yeah, so you do see the thin edge periodically, but it appears always at about a 25 degree, well, it's 27.6 degrees exactly, angle to us. So we do see it in profile, but only briefly, and then it swaps around and starts to grow again.
Yeah.
Just kind of like the same way the moon changes, the shadow across the moon of the Earth changes every so often. And so at the period of the month, you'll see more of the moon illuminated by the sun. But it's exactly the same thing as the seasons change, as the days progress. We'll see more and less of the rings, but fortunately we can see quite a lot. I think Galileo originally thought that Saturn was kind of pulsing, blinking, as it were, because the rings have quite a bright albedo, certainly two of them do. And as it turns, Saturn appears to grow in size. So originally it was thought that it was blinking, that it was some sort of star. But no, on closer inspection, it's a planet that's getting wider and thinner as it rotates. So yeah, the question, I guess, at the start of this was, do the rings look like the space rock fields of the movie screen up close? And the answer is, well, yes and no. The distance between those rocks is large enough to is not really large enough to obscure a car-sized spaceship so vast that to make it look so dramatic as it does in the film. So similarly, the depth of the rings is so slight compared to the endless seas of rocks we see in the film that, again, it wouldn't be very dramatic to fly through it. You'd kind of just be like, oh, I'm through the other side, and that's it. It wouldn't take very long at all. But that said, it's far more beautiful, I think, than the Hollywood depiction kind of gives it credit for. There's a lot more gas and substance to the rings of Saturn than we thought there was going to be. And so, yeah, it's not these huge rocks that you see on the Hollywood screen. No, they are there. They're just much more few and far between. And what we have is this kind of more gossamer, low-density kind of cloud, which is very interesting and probably accounts for why it has such a high albedo. We can see it so far away. So yeah, that's just a little bit about Saturn, really, and how beautiful it is and how weird it is and how it won't be around forever.
Nice one. thank you very much, as always, for elevating our celestial knowledge.
That's all right.
I think it's time, gentlemen. The time, of course, for the miscellaneous multimedia recommendation, of course, as always, to round us off on the end of another podcast. I have definitely recommended mine before, but this one was just so good. Scary Pockets, once again. This one came out today. Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger, the Daft Punk tune, with a bit of big band thrown in, and it's just delicious. Go and take a gander. Scary Pockets. Actually, I should be, I hope, getting their vinyl.
Very nice.
I supported their top-tier Patreon for just sort of a one monthly cycle thing, and hopefully that gets me on the list, because I can't afford that every month. That would be insane. But we shall see. Scary Pockets, most recent video on the channel. It's just great. Check it out.
I have a music-based one, if you want to round us off, Pete.
Mm.
This is a artist that I can't remember how I came to be aware of them, but they're a South African band and sort of production duo called Goldfish. I thoroughly recommend you check out their stuff. The album I'm going to recommend new listeners is Get Busy Living, because it has the titular track Get Busy Living on it, which is just a fantastic jam, simple but effective. Their thing is, and certainly when I was watching them years ago, they have some cool YouTube videos taking automation away from dance music. So they have their drums and their pianos, and they do a sort of loop thing on stage to get that going, and then they'll bring in an electric double bass and a saxophone recorded live, and that will be their hook or their bass line. And so they try and fold in as much acoustic music into a loop based production as they can, but their album versions is just as good. And so yeah, Get Busy Living is a fantastic record that I thoroughly recommend. It's kind of like house with some sort of sampled vocals, and the hooks are mainly played on saxophone or piano, but it sounds fantastic, and it's just a really strange way to do dance music, and I quite like it. So that's Goldfish.
I'll definitely take a listen. Fire away, Pete. What have you brought for us?
This one will appeal to your sense of, we've discussed many times about people.
The thing that we haven't quite got a word for yet.
Well, sort of that. I mean, I'm talking about watching people doing stuff exceedingly well.
Basking in an essence of mastery.
I just want to preface this with, I'm not particularly into guitars in any shape or form, but this is a YouTube channel called Stu Mac. And Stu Mac are a business that sell specialist tools for luthiers, i.e. guitar makers or repairers or technicians. And all the videos feature guitar repairs, basically, in one shape or form, or sometimes they look at other bits and pieces, but predominantly it's doing stuff with broken guitars. I find it quite fascinating. You wouldn't believe what you can do to a guitar. You know, a lot of them you would expect to be too far gone. You know, neck snapped off or great big gouges, holes.
There's a thumbnail here with literally acoustic guitar with what looks like a burnt hole in the top.
Well, wow. That particular one is a very famous guitar, because I believe that is Willie Nelson's guitar.
Yeah.
And it actually has a name.
It's called Trigger.
Yes, that's the one.
For some reason.
That is actually a two-part video.
Okay.
The gentleman in question who works on it has been working on that guitar for years, and they don't try to remedy things like the big gaping hole. They just say, well, it's got another sound hole. But that's literally been worn away by Willie Nelson picking away at the strings. With his particular technique is very sort of grabby, if you want to say, and he's just eaten a hole in the body of the guitar just below where he picks at the strings. But all they do in that particular video is just slightly unsavory in some respects. He goes, I just like to clean off the detritus, which is mostly dead skin, and and then apply a bit of sort of lacquer to the bare wood just to keep it. So it's a preservation thing.
Yeah.
Apparently they try to recreate the guitar because it is a Frankenstein. It's got the special sort of pickup from a guitar he had previously. And I think it's a Martin body,
right.
The gentleman on the video who was saying. And they tried to recreate it for him, and he just wasn't interested in this. It was used as a spare for Trigger. So he intends to go to the grave with the guitar.
Yeah.
There's a lot of famous people's guitars they tackle. As I say, I just like the woodworkery, especially like some of the specialist tools. In fact, there was one particular one I was thinking of ordering. I don't particularly need it, but I just thought I'd got to have one. And it's a jig to make your one of those small Dremel drills. into a little router. So it's like
that's really cool.
It's like a routing plate with spring loaded, and you can lower.
Yeah.
The, you know,
that'll be for inlays and things on the fretboard.
Yeah, exactly, for doing inlays, and they do a lot of routing. They do. I mean, some of the fancier guitars have got inlays all around the edge of the guitar and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's quite interesting seeing them replacing it or installing that stuff. And they sometimes they do sort of brand new guitars from scratch, and then sometimes it's just a repair. But again, they're very good at it, so it's very therapeutic. That I've often said, when you watch these type of videos, and it could be any type of craftsman or proficient technician or someone who's very good at doing what they do, there's no fear when you're watching them. You're not sort of you're not in your edge of your seat thinking, oh no, it's going to go wrong. You just could sit back and relax with the confidence that they're going to do something very skillful for you to witness and enjoy.
Lovely stuff. So that's Stew Mac. Stew is in the stew you eat, Stewmac. Thank you, Pete and Luke, for joining me on episode, what are we on, 67. We hope our listeners do return. Thank you for your support, and stay safe out there. Farewell. I'm raising my hand in farewell, but you can't see it, but you're hearing my strange voice. Goodbye. We'll be right back.